Imagine waking up on August 23rd, logging into your PlayStation, and realizing millions of players around the world have just deliberately plunged the network into darkness.
Yeah, that is a really striking visual.
Right, like you try to check your friends list or look at the storefront or even load into a multiplayer match, and there is just this eerie, unprecedented silence.
Yeah.
And next month, that won't just be an idea. It is, it's going to be a reality.
It is. And what is truly fascinating here is the strategy behind it, because we like to assume that when we purchase our media, you know, the transaction is clean and final.
Yeah, you bought it. It's yours.
Exactly. But we are realizing that the initial purchase is starting to look a lot more like, well, like a down payment on a long-term rental agreement.
Welcome to today's deep dive. It is Monday, July 27, 2026, and we are unpacking a remarkably dense news drop from Tekken Gamers.
Lots to get through today.
Definitely. But we aren't just going to read you the headlines today. We have a very specific mission. We are going to explore this this seismic through line hidden across all of these stories.
Right. It's a massive tug of war for control.
Exactly. An escalating tug of war happening between giant corporations, bold creators, and everyday consumers just like you.
And we are seeing this battleground literally everywhere. I mean, it is happening in the hardware, sitting right under your television.
Yeah.
It is playing out in the boardrooms of blockbuster movie studios. And it is even dictating the momentum in global financial markets.
It's all connected.
It really is. The fundamental question everyone is fighting over right now is, who actually owns the experience?
Okay, let's unpack this by starting with what might be the most direct confrontation we have seen in the gaming industry in years.
The PlayStation Blackout.
The great PlayStation Blackout, yeah. If you haven't been following the forums, gamers are organizing this highly coordinated boycott spanning from August 23rd to August 30th of this year.
A full week.
For one full week, yeah. They are planning to completely power down their consoles and refuse to spend a single cent on the PlayStation Digital Store.
And this is a direct retaliation against Sony's controversial roadmap to discontinue physical disc drives starting in 2028.
Right.
But what makes this particular protest so sophisticated isn't just the sheer scale of the participation. It is it's the specific metric they are targeting.
Yeah, I want to pause on that, because targeting active users rather than just, you know, signing a petition seems incredibly calculated. Why that specific metric?
Because in the modern digital economy, engagement is the ultimate currency. Those active user metrics are directly tied to the company's stock value and, well, advertiser confidence, too.
Oh, wow. So it's a direct hit to the wallet.
Exactly. If millions of users simultaneously go dark for a week, those engagement graphs just plummet. That sends a shockwave straight to the quarterly financial report.
Which is what they care about most.
Right. Internal sources are indicating that senior management is genuinely concerned, because this hits the one language they are absolutely required to respond to: shareholder value.
They probably should be sweating, honestly. The Don't Kill the Disc petition just crossed 345,000 signatures, and it's accelerating.
It is.
You also have these prominent gaming YouTubers, guys like Angry Joe and Young Ye, openly rallying their millions of subscribers to participate in this blackout.
Yeah, and to understand the momentum here, we really have to look at the underlying mechanics of the argument. Like, why do consumers care so deeply about a piece of plastic when gigabit internet can download a game in minutes?
Right.
Well, the sources lay out some pretty compelling psychological and economic drivers. First is the preservation aspect.
Oh, absolutely.
The community hasn't forgotten what happened when Sony shut down the legacy servers for the PSP and the Vita. Countless digital-only games were simply lost to the ether.
Yeah, that sting definitely hasn't faded for a lot of people. Plus, there is the undeniable economic reality of it all. Going entirely digital means the complete destruction of the secondhand market.
Completely gone.
You cannot trade in a digital download to a local game shop. You can't lend it to your neighbor. And physical games traditionally see steep price drops way faster than digital storefronts do.
That's a huge point.
I always look at it this way. Buying a digital game is like renting an apartment where the landlord can just change the locks anytime they feel like it. Owning a physical disc means you actually own the house. You hold the keys.
That is a brilliant way to frame the DRM, digital rights management dilemma. It perfectly illustrates the stark difference between real ownership and just having a revocable license.
Yeah.
We are even seeing industry heavyweights jump into this debate at Comic-Con last weekend. Dan Houser, you know, the co-founder of Rockstar Games, who left to start Absurd Ventures, he weighed in.
What did he have to say?
Well, he personally leans toward the convenience of digital downloads for his own use, but his business stance was crystal clear. He stated, if people want it, companies should provide it.
And Laszlo Jones chimed in as well. The veteran writer and producer for the Grand Theft Auto series, he asked, why can't we have both? Digital is convenient, physical is tangible.
Right.
And let's be honest about the industry dynamics here.
Right.
Rockstar's DNA carries monumental weight. Like, if Rockstar tells a publisher, like Take-Two, that Grand Theft Auto 6 requires a physical release, Take-Two doesn't really have the leverage to say no.
They absolutely do not. Rockstar can completely dictate their own terms, but this raises an important question regarding power dynamics for the average consumer. Who holds the power over the product after the credit card is swiped?
That's the core issue.
Exactly. When you buy a disc, the power transfers to your physical shelf. When you buy a digital license, the corporation retains the perpetual power to alter, remove, or restrict that product. This blackout is basically an attempt to use collective consumer gravity to force a corporate policy reversal.
I hear that argument, and, you know, the landlord analogy makes sense, but I do have to push back a little here. Isn't digital distribution just inevitable technological progress? Like, we saw this with streaming music and movies. Aren't these gamers just fighting gravity at this point?
It is a totally fair challenge. It certainly feels like fighting gravity. But what we are observing isn't some natural law of physics. It is a deliberate, engineered business strategy.
How so?
Well, companies want to lower their physical distribution costs and monopolize the point of sale. If the PlayStation Digital Store is the singular place you can purchase a PlayStation game, Sony controls the pricing ecosystem entirely.
Oh, right. No competition.
Exactly. Dan Houser noted, it is simple economics to meet consumer demand. Sony's strategy, however, is testing whether they can artificially suppress that demand by just completely removing the physical option from the table.
That actually transitions us perfectly into our next story.
Yeah.
Because while Sony is facing a revolt for trying to pull the plug on physical media, Nintendo is actively trying to preserve it with the upcoming Switch 2 console.
They are, yeah.
But in doing so, they are highlighting exactly why physical media is becoming such a colossal logistical headache for manufacturers.
The reality of physical manufacturing in 2026 is colliding head-on with the raw demands of modern game development.
Case in point, Xenoblade Chronicles 2 Switch 2 Edition. Nintendo just released the technical details, and the file size is staggering. It clocks in at 45.8 gigabytes.
Which is massive.
It is. For context, the original game on the first Switch was only 13.2 gigs. We are talking about a footprint nearly 3.5 times larger.
And that ballooning file size isn't just a matter of unoptimized code, you know? It is the literal cost of next-generation fidelity.
Right, the graphics.
Yeah, the Switch 2 version is pushing 4K resolution at 60 frames per second when docked to a television, and a rock-solid 1080p at 60 frames in handheld mode.
Which is a huge jump.
A massive jump. If you recall the original release, it often struggled. It would dip down to a blurry 540p in handheld and rarely maintained a smooth frame rate. Upgrading all those textures and lighting systems, it just takes up an enormous amount of data.
It's not just the graphical overhaul, though. They are packing in highly requested gameplay content that requires extra storage, too.
Right, the new features.
Yeah, the developers are including the Momo Blade. For those listening who aren't deep into the franchise, that was a highly anticipated piece of character content cut from the original game that fans have been begging for.
Such a great addition.
And they're also adding a brand new endgame loop called Merc Assault Mode to keep players engaged long after the credits roll, plus some new outfits for Pyra and Mithra.
It is an incredibly robust package. However, this is where the physical versus digital debate hits a pretty severe economic roadblock.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The digital version drops in just a few days on July 30th, and it's priced at $59.99.
Okay.
But if you want that physical copy-like, if you want the actual cartridge for your shelf, you have to wait 2 entire months until October 1st, and you have to pay $69.99.
Yeah.
That is a $10 premium.
And that premium exists because Nintendo is utilizing a 64-gigabyte cartridge for the very first time in the company's history.
Right. Now, if you are listening to this and thinking, hey, I would happily wait 2 months and pay 10 bucks for a physical game, Nintendo's basically betting you're in the minority.
Unfortunately, yeah.
But I have to ask you, is this an intentional tax on physical media to nudge people toward the digital store? Or is this just the harsh economic reality of manufacturing a 64-gigabyte piece of plastic?
It is fundamentally the latter. Unlike stamping a cheap polycarbonate Blu-ray disc, creating solid-state flash memory cartridges at that capacity is incredibly expensive.
Oh, for sure.
If we synthesize this with Danhauser's earlier point, companies will provide physical media if consumers demand it, and Nintendo is proving that they will. But the leap to next-gen graphics requires so much storage data that the manufacturing costs just skyrocket.
And they aren't going to eat that cost.
Exactly. Nintendo is refusing to absorb that loss, so they are passing the supply chain costs directly onto the consumer. It basically proves that preserving physical ownership today comes with a literal premium price tag and logistical delays.
So the landscape is really fractured right now. On one side, Sony is trying to rip the Band-Aid off entirely and facing this huge grassroots revolt.
Right.
On the other, Nintendo is offering the physical option but saying, look, you are going to pay the manufacturing premium and you are going to wait for the factories to catch up.
That is the exact dynamic.
Yeah.
And, this broader struggle for control isn't just confined to gaming hardware and distribution.
Where else are we seeing it?
We are seeing a striking parallel in Hollywood where the battle is being waged over narrative and creative IP control. The old top-down studio system is really starting to fracture.
The Comic-Con bombshells just keep coming. We definitely need to talk about Marvel's latest pivot. Ryan Gosling has been officially announced to play Johnny Blaze Ghost Rider in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, slated for a 2028 release.
Which is an incredibly bold swing for the studio.
It is.
If you look at the cinematic track record of Ghost Rider, it is rough. You had the Nicolas Cage adaptations in 2007 and 2011.
Oh, man. Yep.
The first one pulled in $228 million, but was critically panned. And the sequel, Spirit of Vengeance, totally cratered at a $132 million box office. The character has historically just failed to find its footing on screen.
But the industry buzz around this 2028 version feels completely different, primarily because of how the project originated.
Right.
According to Marvel Studios president Kevin Feige, Ryan Gosling personally approached him with a very specific vision for the character. Gosling isn't just a hired actor reading lines here. He is acting as the core creative architect.
What's fascinating here is the shift in trust. Historically, mega studios have been highly protective of their established intellectual property,
And they
right?
don't want control.
Exactly. They rely on algorithmic safety and committee decisions to guarantee a baseline box office return. But after recent superhero fatigue, they are realizing that creator-driven passion might be the only way to get audiences back into theater seats.
That makes a lot of sense.
And Gosling has earned a unique kind of leverage. Consider his versatility. He anchored a dense sci-fi epic like Blade Runner 2049, delivered flawless comedic timing in The Nice Guys and La La Land, and then pulled off Barbie.
The Barbie casting is the perfect example, honestly. The internet thought his casting as Ken might be a disaster, and he turned it into an absolute cultural icon.
He really did.
Plus, he is teaming up with director Shawn Levy, who just dominated the summer 2026 box office with Deadpool and Wolverine, bringing in over $1.2 billion. Levy understands how to balance chaotic action with actual emotional stakes.
When a talent with Gosling's track record walks into a room with a deep, passionate vision, the studio essentially just hands over the keys. It is a prime example of a creator seizing control from the traditional risk-averse studio apparatus to take a substantial gamble on a legacy character.
Speaking of taking substantial gambles with beloved legacy properties, HBO is currently going completely rogue with House of the Dragon.
They really are throwing the playbook out the window. Episode 6 of Season 3 just delivered a finale that left the fan base entirely stunned.
Yeah, for the listeners who haven't caught up, Corlys Velaryon the Sea Snake was brutally attacked in a surprise assault.
Out of nowhere.
Totally out of nowhere. His fate is completely unknown, and they left a bloody message reading, "Kick this dog and it will bite your hand."
This is where the creative control aspect really crystallizes, because this specific event is a major departure from the source material, George R.R. Martin's book, Fire and Blood.
Right.
In the written history, Corlys survives the war. The showrunners have deliberately chosen to veer off the established path and just rewrite the canon.
They are keeping some historical beats accurate, though, right? Like, in that same episode, Sir Christian Cole met his end exactly as he does in the book.
Yes, that part stayed true.
Which sets up the board for the highly anticipated Battle of Tumbleton in Episode 7. We're looking at 4 dragons for the blacks and 3 for the greens. But so, what does this all mean? I have to ask about the strategy here. Gosling pitching his own Marvel movie makes sense. He's a proven box office draw. But isn't alienating the hardcore book readers a terrifying gamble for a production as massive and expensive as House of the Dragon.
It is an immense gamble. But, you know, the calculus in Hollywood is evolving. Sticking safely to the past, whether that is trying to replicate a stale early 2000s superhero formula or strictly adhering to a book's Wikipedia plot summary, is sometimes actually riskier than embracing a passionate new vision.
Oh, that's a good point.
Modern audiences are incredibly savvy. They can feel when a show is meticulously crafted by a committee trying not to offend anyone versus when it has a true, unpredictable creative pulse. The showrunners are willing to risk the wrath of book purists to claim genuine ownership over the television narrative.
They want to build their own house, not just paint someone else's.
Beautifully said.
I want to pull the lens way back now, because we have seen retail consumers demanding power from Sony and actors demanding power from Marvel Studios. But the ultimate test of this David versus Goliath power struggle is happening in the financial markets right now.
Yeah, it really is.
Every day, retail traders are going head-to-head with institutional giants. Because, let's face it, none of this entertainment industry machinery works unless everyday consumers feel financially confident.
And that financial confidence is currently being heavily dictated by global geopolitics, which is fascinatingly reflected in today's cryptocurrency markets.
Yeah, the Tick and Gamers report gave us some intriguing numbers today. Bitcoin has bounced back above $65,400, which is up 1.2% on the day.
Okay.
And Ethereum actually outperformed it, rising 3% to cross $1,950.
To understand the mechanics of why those digital assets are rising, we have to look at the broader geopolitical catalyst.
Which is?
The source notes a sudden diplomatic easing of tensions between the U.S. and Iran. As a direct result of that relative calm, Brent crude oil prices dropped 5%, falling below $92 a barrel after peaking at $97 just last week.
Let's trace that domino effect for the listener. Why does diplomatic calm and cheaper oil make digital currency go up?
It all comes down to global risk appetite. When oil prices are spiking due to the threat of international conflict, financial markets get incredibly nervous.
Sure, people panic.
Right. Institutional money flees to safe haven assets because they fear inflation and supply chain collapse. But when tensions ease and oil drops, the broader market breathes a collective sigh of relief.
They relax a bit.
Exactly. Investors feel less worried about an imminent global crisis, so they become far more willing to deploy their capital into higher risk, higher reward assets like cryptocurrency.
But there is a glaring contradiction happening right under the surface of these rising prices.
What's that?
The source data shows that about $240 million exited U.S. Bitcoin ETFs this week. Now, for the listener who doesn't trade crypto, an ETF is an exchange-traded fund, essentially a traditional Wall Street wrapper that allows giant institutions to invest in Bitcoin without having to actually manage the digital wallets themselves.
Exactly.
So the big Wall Street funds are actually pulling their money out.
That is correct. We can look at the Fear and Greed Index, which is a metric that aggregates market sentiment, things like volatility, momentum, and social media trends. Right now, it is sitting at 42, which is dead neutral.
Wow. Okay.
The institutional money is playing it incredibly cautious. They are securing their profits, de-risking their portfolios, and stepping back to wait and see what happens next. Analysts note the market has basically stabilized in the $63,000 to $67,000 range.
Wait, let me stop you there, because this is where I am confused.
Sure.
If the smartest guys in the room, you know, the massive institutional funds, are selling off and pulling out $240 million, why is the price still going up? Aren't everyday retail buyers just catching a falling knife? Why are regular people confident when the banks are terrified?
Because the retail buyers and the crypto whales, the individual heavy hitters, are aggressively stepping in to buy up the supply that the institutions are dumping.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, they are entirely absorbing the ETF outflows. The retail sector believes in the long-term thesis of the asset enough to act as the counterweight to Wall Street's short-term caution.
It's wild. It is like watching passengers carefully bail out of a life raft, because the water looks a bit choppy, while a bunch of determined swimmers willingly climb aboard to take their seats.
That's a great analogy.
It mirrors the PlayStation boycott perfectly, too. You have everyday people taking control and driving the momentum when the monolithic corporate entities get overly cautious or try to dictate the terms of engagement.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it highlights a profound societal shift. Whether it is retail crypto investors absorbing institutional sell-offs, or gamers coordinating a global blackout to preserve their physical media rights, or an actor demanding creative control from a monolithic movie studio, the dynamic is identical.
It's all the same fight.
Exactly. Power is no longer flowing strictly top-down. It is a constant, active, and highly public negotiation.
And for the crypto market, it sounds like that negotiation is waiting on the next macroeconomic catalyst. Like, if geopolitical news stays positive, it could break that $67,000 ceiling.
Absolutely.
But if negative global news hits, it is entirely tethered to that stability and could slide back down.
Which perfectly illustrates that our digital economies and our entertainment ecosystems do not exist in a vacuum. They are directly downstream from global realities.
We have covered some truly fascinating ground today on this deep dive. We started by examining a grassroots rebellion, with gamers planning a coordinated PlayStation blackout to protect the fundamental right to physically own their purchases.
We then explored Nintendo's 64-gigabyte cartridge compromise with Xenoblade Chronicles 2, revealing that while hardware companies can provide physical media, the consumer is ultimately going to bear the logistical costs of next-generation fidelity.
Right, and we tracked the escalating fight for creative control in Hollywood, analyzing why Ryan Gosling is taking the reins of Ghost Rider and why the House of the Dragon showrunners are taking monumental risks by altering George R. R. Martin's established history.
And finally, we broke down how geopolitical calm and falling oil prices directly fuel the retail investors who are currently propping up the cryptocurrency market against institutional caution.
Right.
It all comes full circle to that transaction we discussed at the very beginning. The moment you hand over your money, the relationship used to end. Now, it is just the opening bell for a complex power struggle.
I'll leave you with this. If digital licenses can be revoked at any time by a corporation like Sony, and if institutional giants are pulling out of financial markets while retail steps up, are we entering a brand new era where the concept of ownership, whether it is a video game, a cryptocurrency portfolio, or even the storyline of our favorite television show, belongs entirely to whoever is willing to fight the hardest for it?
That is an incredibly provocative thought to ponder. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive today. Keep questioning the information around you, keep examining the mechanics of the media you consume, and we will see you next time.